Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 52 and our December 2023 edition of our live monthly Q&A with Cinten's employment team. I'm still David Pritchard, Head of Marketing at Cinten's. We have two speakers for you this morning. They're on the screen in front of you. We have partner Max Winthrop, and welcoming back from maternity leave, and we're delighted to have her back, and I was delighted to see her this week, Senior Associate Ailsa Hobson. Same format as with every month with all 51 plus this episode of this live Q&A, three questions that you've sent through to us over the course of last month. Max is going to go first. That's enough for me. Max, good morning, and over to you for question one.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Well, first question, you'll see from the printout there, the screen, the question about collective redundancies. So this is a tricky area, and it's full of pitfalls for both employers and employees. But let's just dive into that question. So I'm sure many of those listening will know the basics here. So that when we're talking about collective redundancies, where the employer is proposing to dismiss more than 20 but less than 100, there's an obligation to consult. Once you get over 100, a consultation period goes up to 45 days. Those with long memories might remember that one time it used to be 90 days for the consultation. That's been cut down, but there is a significance in 90. 90 days is the number of days that can potentially be awarded for a failure to get the collective consultations right. And that's 90 days of uncapped pay. So the stakes are pretty high here. Now, sort of breaking that question down, there's a reference there to having finished the consultation process. Now, that might give us a bit of clues to the correct answer here, because you could have a discrete consultation process that looks at, for example, dismissing, say, more than 20 from a particular department. That process goes through. Those redundancies have been made, and you could say in those circumstances that process is over. But I think what the question is getting at is probably where you've got a more elastic approach to what's been going on. And it's an unfortunate feature of collective redundancies that the business may start out thinking, well, we've looked at our financial resourcing, we reckon that we've got to make severe cuts, but we'll get away with making cuts of whatever the number is. The process goes on, cuts are made, redundancies are declared, but you then find that still more jobs, unfortunately, are going to have to be lost. Now, remember the two things going on in that collective process. The Trade Union Labour Relations Consolidation Act has kind of like a code that explains to the employer what they have to do, how they have to consult with reps, and also sets out obligations with regard to filing what's called the HR1 form. So two things are happening here. You've got those kind of conventional employment obligations with regard to reps or recognised trade unions, and you've also got the obligation to file with the Secretary of State the HR1 form. That actually, if you fail to do that properly, it creates a criminal liability. Although, to be fair, there've been almost, well, I think in the last, ever since we've had that legislation, there've only been a couple of prosecutions. And the real attention is always on those Section 188 obligations. Now, the two things are separate. The significance of that is that the Section 188 obligation, your collective obligation, can be stretched out. So you could have a process that has overrun the time limit that you've kind of need to observe prior to any dismissals being made. And you have to kind of finish off with a few more dismissals. Now, if you're looking at a scenario where there's only a few more, probably you're not going to have too much problem. Think about it. You're looking at two potential scenarios, aren't you? 20 or more than 100. Danger areas would be where you're getting up to close on a 100, but you've only consulted on the basis that you'd have less than 100 redundancies. Now, there's some assistance from the case law here. The tribunals have looked at this and they've sort of said that where you've got an ongoing process involving the same group of employees and you find that your original plans have to be stretched, the tribunal will take a flexible approach to that. We've seen that in a case called the Vauxhall Motors decision, where the scenario really was quite stretched, so that the final redundancies in the process took place about 18 months after the consultation process had started. Now, whilst the first instance tribunal had a look at that and said, no, that's not right, on appeal, EAT said, no, Vauxhall have acted properly here. This was a scenario where the consultation between the parties could be stretched in the way that it did. Interestingly, in that particular case, Vauxhall had actually gone to the extent of serving fresh HR1 forms. So I think, as I said, it's a dangerous and tricky area that you've got to look at, but potentially there are solutions here to the type of problem where the redundancy exercise unfortunately gets stretched into the future. It's one I would emphasize those pitfalls though, and definitely one to take advice on, and really that advice would be most effective before you get into the consultation process. Don't forget, you may have to take steps to get workplace reps elected if you don't already have a recognition agreement with the trade union to negotiate with, and there are pitfalls there, and as I said, do be very cautious in any collective exercise. Well, I'll now hand you over to Elsa.
Thanks, Max. Sorry. And again, David was very polite at the outset of this. Hello, everyone, and thanks for having me back. He didn't mention that we were 8 minutes late joining, and that was completely my fault, down to just a meltdown of my laptop, which I'm not using my own. So I'll apologise for that, but hopefully you'll forgive me just this once. So my question today is, can an employee take on paid work with another employer whilst on statutory maternity leave without there being any impact on their maternity leave and pay? So it's a bit of a no and yes answer, but I'll explain why. So I'm not aware of any reasons why the maternity leave from the employer's main employer would automatically cease where that person carries out work for a different employer or undertakes work on a self-employed basis during that period of maternity leave. So provided they've complied with their notification requirements for that leave, so they've given their employer the due notice, then they're entitled to take the full ordinary and additional maternity leave without any disruption, so they can work for somebody else during that period. However, the position is different when it comes to the statutory maternity pay, so SMP. If she is still in receipt of SMP, which is paid for the 39 weeks of the leave, the legislation covering this confirms that this will stop altogether if the employee works for a new employer after the child is born. So that that applies whether or not they remain with their original employer throughout that period. So if they, for example, resigned and start a new employer and then resign from their old employer, they would still lose that entitlement to SMP. So it means they'll have no right to SMP in the week which they start work or in any subsequent week thereafter. It won't resume if she were to cease that employment. So you do need to check with the contract, because generally you'll find in any employment contract there's an obligation to get permission from your original employer to work for a secondary employer, and sometimes there's a complete prohibition on that. So it's important that that individual has the contractual right to work for a secondary employer, and if they do without permission, then there's nothing preventing them doing that during that period of maternity leave. But obviously the pace is slightly different. It's not part of the question, but I suppose it touches base. Sometimes you might find that employees want to undertake additional casual work for their same employer during maternity leave, maybe to make a bit extra money. And the legislation on this is even less clear, ultimately, because if you undertake work other than those 10 kit days that are designated under the legislation, it brings maternity leave and pay to an automatic end if you're undertaking work that you've not permitted to do, basically. So that's where the legislation sits, but the point itself has never been tested. It's not one I would want to test, but I suppose it might happen, but it's still very clear cut when it comes to the pay. You absolutely lose your right to SNP if you undertake any work outside those 10 kit days. So it's just one to watch out for, and I suppose just keeping that open dialogue with all of your employees, especially those on maternity leave, then you should be able to get around any obstacles that arise. So that was quite a whistle stop tour on that one. So I'll pass you back to Max for the third and final question. Thank you.
Thanks, Ailsa. So next question, what action can we take if an employee discloses an alcohol addiction during a disciplinary investigation into allegations of alcohol consumption at work? Very interesting question, and quite a lot there, really. So breaking it down, I suppose the first point is that I'm guessing that more or less everyone out there would accept drinking in the workplace as a potential disciplinary issue. It's one of those traditional things, isn't it, that you often see along with things like clocking offences and acts of physical and violence that justify dismissal for gross misconduct. But remember, when it comes to ordinary unfair dismissal, perhaps I should say even when it comes to ordinary unfair dismissal, where you've got an employee who's qualified to bring such claims, the mere fact that the action could potentially be gross misconduct doesn't discharge all your usual burdens when it comes to a proper investigation. I'll come back to that point in a moment, but let's also now think about alcohol addiction in broader terms. That may be indicative of an underlying condition. Now, again, I'm sure many listening will remember that under the Equality Act provisions, the definition of disability, there are certain exclusions. They kind of fall into two groups. There's those slightly strange ones about things like voyeurism and exhibitionism. So a tendency to those attributes doesn't necessarily make you a disabled person. And there's also addictions. So that if you've got an addiction, that addiction itself excludes the operation of the act. In other words, I mean that the mere fact that you are, say, an alcoholic or you're dependent on drugs doesn't, by that, on that alone, qualify you as a disabled person, if I can put it that way. Now, even there's an exception. If you've got that way because of the result that the whatever drug you're addicted to has been prescribed medically, then the fact that it's been prescribed medically means that your condition will, in fact, potentially qualify you as a disabled person. Now, I'm pretty certain that alcohol is not prescribed, at least in this day and age, medically. So that alcohol addiction takes you outside the scope of the protection of the Act. But as I said earlier, it could be an indicator of some other condition. So, for example, if as part of severe depression, someone has acquired an alcohol addiction, then what the tribunal will be interested in is that depressive illness. And it doesn't really, the tribunal won't, in a disability type claim, consider questions of how the person came to acquire that particular disability. So if we go back to our disciplinary hearing where the individual has raised the question of alcohol addiction, it could be that the employer in those circumstances is going to have to look carefully at saying, is this something that indicates to us we should be considering whether or not we're dealing with a person under a disability, a person with a disabling condition? And that could mean changes to how you conduct the disciplinary hearing itself. If you're dealing with some sort of mental impairment, are there ways in which the disciplinary process should be adjusted? Should it be, for example, a face-to-face meeting, or indeed, should it be something conducted through Teams because the mental condition in play means that the person can't react to or concentrate in particular circumstances. So you might have to look at how you change the process itself. And then just going back to alcohol consumption at work, the point I made earlier, this idea of unfair dismissal, it's important not to forget that even with serious allegations, perhaps especially with serious allegations, the fact the allegation isn't proof in itself. So there's got to be a proper proof. We all know the tests that are applied in the tribunal, where it's looking for a range of reasonable responses. And that applies even with alcohol cases. So again, some listeners might, within their workplaces, for example, have a policy of random drug testing. Now, that will be highly completely appropriate in those workplaces where, for example, health and safety requires sobriety. But even there, don't forget that there can be false positives thrown up by testing. We've seen that in a couple of cases. There's one called First Bristol and Bales. That wasn't actually alcohol addiction, but it was drug addiction that the random test threw up. But in that particular instance, you're talking about an employee with very considerable number of years service, all of which are exemplary, no previous disciplinary issues, and the rather interesting possibility came up. This was a bus driver, as the name of the case suggests, and what the bus driver said was, well, look, in my job as a driver, I handle banknotes. Well, so what's that significant? Well, the significance is this, apparently, so it said in the case, I don't know from personal experience, but banknotes are what you use when you snort up a load of cocaine. So if you handle banknotes, your hands can get contaminated with cocaine, and that can lead to a positive result in a test. Also, some of these tests are not necessarily perfect. They can produce what are called false positives. Now, false positives means it's a result that says somebody has consumed alcohol or drugs when in fact they haven't. And in this particular case, quite unusually, the employee got a hair strand test done that proved he hadn't taken the drugs in question. Now, with all that material in play, what the tribunal said was that no reasonable employer, having regard to the length of service, the possibility of doubt as to whether or not Mr. Bales had taken the drug in question, would lead a reasonable employer to contemplate dismissal. And so that was a dismissal that was unfair, notwithstanding a drug test. Now, do contrast that with a more classic example of someone illicitly drinking on the production line, alcohol is found on their person or in their locker or whatever, you're probably not necessarily going to need to go to the depths that we saw in that particular case, First Bristol and Bales. But nevertheless, there'll still need to be a fair process. But if you are talking about somebody who unfortunately has alcoholism and that's kind of isolated on its own, that won't mean they're a disabled person. So duty of fairness, yes, but it won't mean adjustments to your normal process, provided they're careful in the usual way. The inevitable result there would be dismissal. So I hope that covers those points. That's about it from me. So this being both Christmas time and the end of Hanukkah, appropriate opportunity to wish you Happy Christmas or Semeach Hanukkah, depending on your preferences. So I look forward to seeing you in the new year. And back to Dave.
Thanks very much to both of you. Enjoyed that one, as always. Very quickly for me, as I say, at the end of each of these sessions, we continue to work hard to produce, release, deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. That includes all episodes of this Q&A series that we started back in April of 2020. If you haven't heard enough from us by that point, you can also follow the team on Twitter at SintonsHR or at SintonsLaw. And just a point on the website, there is so much useful content on there from an employment point of view, including all our seminars, live versions of those. So please do check it out. There's a lot of, as I say, really, really useful and relevant content there. I put our speakers' details back on the screen if you'd like to get in touch with them with regards to anything they've raised today or in any of the sessions. Please don't hesitate. Telephone numbers are there for people listening to this via podcast. I'll just go through them for Max. 01912263703, email max.winthrop@sintons.co.uk. And for our lovely Elsa, 01912263705, elsa.hobson@sintons.co.uk. That's it from us for this month. That's it from us for 2023. Just on behalf of all of us, the entire team, thank you so much for your engagement with these sessions. For something that we started as a weekly thing back at the outset of COVID has grown into something that is a stalwart in the calendar each month. We get questions in droves. The amount of people that are continuing to tune into these live each month and then to watch the video afterwards to listen to the podcast is literally staggering, and it's something that we still pinch ourselves about and don't take for granted in any way, shape or form. So thank you for that. We'll be with you back in the last working Friday of January 2024, live on Teams at 10 a.m. So we'll see you then. Have an absolutely wonderful Christmas and a break. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll speak to you next year. Thank you.